ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
You can't have sport at this level without politics. Uh-huh. But seriously, there's no such thing as a FIFA Peace Prize. It was invented to keep Donald Trump on side and on focus to get to the deadline of a FIFA World Cup.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
Well, America and Iran have signed a memorandum of understanding, and while there's still some sporadic fighting and missile strikes and so on, the war might be coming to an end. And maybe the Strait of Hormuz will open, although anything could happen, of course, so who knows. It could be time to reflect now on what has happened and why did our fuel prices go up so much, who benefited from that, how much money did the local refiners make, and more importantly, what happens now? And more broadly, what is the future of Australian oil refining, especially if government support stops next year as it's supposed to? One man at the centre of all this is Matt Halliday, the chief executive of Ampol, one of Australia's biggest fuel retailers and owner of the Lytton Refinery in Brisbane. There's also plenty for companies like Ampol to think about in the rise of electric vehicles and in climate change. So we also talked to Matt Halliday about Ampol's strategy for charging cars instead of just filling them up with petrol and diesel, and also how the company plans to meet its net zero by 2050 commitment. So here's Matt Halliday, the CEO of Ampol. Well, g'day, Matt Halliday. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Alan.
What's your reading of the current situation in the Persian Gulf? I mean, how much oil is getting through and what does all that mean for the supply of crude oil in Australia, for your refinery and for the Asian refineries that we also rely on?
Yeah, so it's certainly been ramping back up in terms of oil coming out of the Strait and indeed some ships going back into the Strait, but it's very fragile. I mean, even in the last few days, we can see that there's been a bit more kinetic activity, and so it just remains very fragile. Our view is it's going to take some time to ramp back up to something like full production, and obviously it depends on how negotiations continue to play out. The crude oil that comes out of there is very important for the Asian refineries that we buy refined fuel products from, typically. Our own refinery doesn't use any Persian Gulf crudes. We use crudes out of Asia and increasingly out of the US.
Right, so the Asian refineries have been drawing on their reserves, I think, or at least have been using kind of stored oil. Have they been running out? I mean, is that likely to get to be a problem if the production from the Persian Gulf doesn't ramp up really quickly?
Yeah, so what has happened? Supply has actually been better than we might have expected, including for those Asian refineries. When you look at what's actually happened, China has ratcheted down its purchases over the last few months of Middle Eastern crudes quite significantly.
By about 40%, I understand.
By about 40%. And so that has meant that the other Asian refineries that we do buy from have been able to source more crude. But having said that, they are working through stocks. The Chinese are working through stocks. And to your question, that can all only last for so long before things become very strained.
Do you think that the free, unrestricted passage of ships through the Strait of Hormuz is now finished and that Iran will now control what goes on there through its Persian Gulf Strait Authority that it's created, and probably with Oman? Do you think that they'll probably charge a toll in the end?
Whether it's called a toll or whether it's called something else, that seems particularly important to them. It's obviously a very tense point around the negotiations, but I think once the Iranians have demonstrated what they're able to do, it's very hard to permanently remove that again.
And do you think it might have an impact on other straits, in particular Straits of Malacca and perhaps the entrance to the Red Sea?
Yeah, I think when you step right back from all of this, the ability to control waterways, to lock in your country from an export point of view, these are all kind of vulnerabilities that are playing out. And I think that because Iran has been so successful in controlling the strait, that is there are vulnerabilities in other straits and waterways that will be have a heightened focus around them going forward.
How do you reflect on the whole episode, the war in Iran? How do you feel about it?
I think it's definitely highlighted the vulnerabilities in fuel security that we've been talking about for the last few years. It highlights the criticality and the strategic nature of refining in Australia, and does highlight the need for national fuel reserves, which many other countries have, in terms of bolstering the resilience of Australia. Because if you do run very tight on fuel, it does effectively flow its way right through the economy relatively quickly.
In fact, on that score, Australia got caught short, didn't it? I mean, it ran down. In fact, I think we had the lowest level of fuel reserves of any country in the International Energy Agency.
Yeah, I think the supply chain has held up very well in terms of being able to adapt and source from further afield and do these things. The government's taken some important steps in terms of, you know, underwriting cargoes beyond today's demand to effectively build resilience. But there's no doubt that the country needs more storage. Those measures have been announced, and our vulnerability has increased as refineries have closed. And I think since 2013, five refineries have closed, and we've only got two left. And that has, as a consequence, led to less days coverage in terms of inventory.
In fact, the government supports the two refineries with what's called the fuel security services payment. Would your refinery, Lytton, closed without that?
Yeah, it would have been extremely challenging, because when you look at Lytton, and in fact the two refineries that remain, Lytton produces about 110,000 barrels a day. It's about 60 years old. We've invested about $1 billion in the refinery over the last 3 years, and it's competing with refineries that are being built that are around four or five times that size, that are modern in other parts of the world. And so that's part of the challenge for domestic refining in Australia.
In fact, I think the scheme runs out in mid-next year, doesn't it? So what happens then?
Yeah, so we're in discussions with the government now around how we can lay out an arrangement that will enable us to invest. And there's billions of dollars to be invested if you want to set the refinery up for the long term. And so that's part of the discussion we're having with them at the moment.
So as a result of the war, the Lytton refinery margin in the first quarter you've announced was $25.45 a barrel, which was double the average of 2025. And I think it's four times what it was in the same quarter last year. You don't set that margin, obviously. It's the difference between the prices of imported products and the prices of imported crude oil. But can you tell me what it meant, what that increase in the margin has meant for you in dollar terms? What sort of profit windfall have you got out of the war?
Yes, yeah, so I can't talk in profit numbers at the moment, but it is a little over in Q1 twice what an average margin would be. And that compares to 2024, where the refinery lost money, and 2025 in the first half, where it broke even. So it's the volatility of refining is one of the challenges that we have. We obviously don't invest for the profit that is there when we hit a geopolitical event like this one. We need to invest for the long term. And over the last 3 years, we've invested over $1 billion. So effectively, any profit we have made is being invested right back into the refinery again. That's for this period. But when we look long term, we need to be able to continue to make very significant investments in what is fundamentally a very volatile margin.
I presume the government gave you some money, you know, under the fuel security services payment when you were losing money in 2024. Do you think it would be reasonable for you to give some of the money back now that you're making tons of it?
We haven't taken any money under the fuel security services payment arrangements, despite the loss in 2024 and break even in 2025. And the reason for that is that costs have gone up a lot. So when the arrangement was initially set, it was set at a level. And the reality is that because cost escalation has impacted those profit margins, we haven't taken any support.
All right. So the government hasn't given you any money to keep the refinery open, even though it was supposed to.
No, it hasn't.
That's really weird.
Yeah. So what's happened was it was set at a break even level during COVID, effectively. And what's happened is effectively the costs have escalated to the point where if our costs had held back at those levels, we would have received support. We didn't receive support because the arrangement wasn't escalated, and you know that'll be one of the issues that's on the table as we go forward. We have now reset for the short term that level, so it will kick in when we're losing money. But really the main game for us is how do we work with the government to ensure that the refinery can be there for the long term? And that requires not just a capital investment program for the next few years, but for the next 10, 20 years, what does that investment profile look like?
Right. So I presume you're saying now that the government does need to provide you with support in order for the Lytton refinery to stay open.
We need to have more confidence in the returns that are going to come out of the investment in an asset like this for the long term, because the refinery economics, as I mentioned earlier, when you're investing in a refinery that is 60 years old, competing against modern refineries that are about five times its size in Asia and other parts of the world, that's a pretty challenging proposition without acknowledging, you know, you need some confidence in returns to make those investments.
But do we really have to have a refinery or two refineries in Australia? I mean, how much of the market do you supply out of Lytton and also Viva supplies out of Geelong? I mean, is it much of the market?
So it's about 20% of Australia's supply. And I think, in my view, I think underpinning and supporting those refineries to be there for the long term is particularly important. This whole situation has demonstrated the role that they do play, particularly because the crude oil that they're using is very different to the crude oil that comes out of the Gulf. So whilst there were some really tight points in terms of refined product supply, we could always secure crude for the refineries, including increasingly out of the United States.
Now, I think the petrol price has returned to pre-war levels, but the diesel price is still a bit above that. Do you think we've seen a structural kind of increase in the diesel price?
I think diesel price will continue to move around with supply. It's been a bit more heavily impacted, certainly. But from a petrol point of view, we're now heading into the Northern Hemisphere sort of driving season, if you like, where just under 90% of the population lives in the Northern Hemisphere. So that starts to put more demand pressure on the gasoline or petrol side of things. But certainly diesel is the product, or diesel and jet fuel have been the product more impacted out of the Middle East, because these sour crudes that come out of the Middle East tend to have a higher proportion of diesel or jet fuel fraction in.
Yeah, I suppose I'm wondering whether there's any structural change to the fuel business, you know, petrol, diesel versus jet fuel as a result of what's been going on.
Yeah, I think what I would point to is there is a structural shift that will happen over time, and that is refineries need to produce a proportion of effectively petrol or gasoline, diesel and jet. And as you're seeing more and more EVs and hybrids come into the system, you need to produce less petrol and more diesel and jet. And how you can navigate that transition requires investment, and that imbalance needs to be managed over time.
Right. So is that part of the investment you're going to have to make in the Lytton refinery?
That'll be part of what we need to contemplate, is how we produce less petrol and more middle distillates or diesel and jet, but that's expensive.
In general, how much are you saying you're going to have to invest in Lytton?
So we're still doing the work. This would be, you know, how you set the refinery up for, say, the next 20 years. It's billions of dollars, but we're still doing the work on exactly what the numbers would look like, because we're thinking longer term than we otherwise might have been.
I suppose the other question is whether it's going to be worth it at all, given what's going on with electric vehicles.
Yeah, I think certainly electric vehicle uptake has increased, and that gives rise to the kind of gasoline versus middle distillates or diesel and jet fuel that I mentioned earlier, and how you adjust the production, which is not easy. But the transition's going to take time. So this change out of the fleet, the average age of a light vehicle or a car in Australia is about 11 years. And you've currently got in Q2, 15% of car sales are EVs. So this takes time. And I think the bigger challenge for Australia is in diesel and jet, where there is no real solution that is economic at the moment. So we're going to need fuel security and fuel supply for a long time to come.
I suppose I'm wondering whether there's a point at which petrol in particular becomes uneconomic. I mean, it isn't, you know, whether it's 30% EVs or 50% EVs, it's not certainly not 100%. At some point, presumably, making and selling petrol doesn't make any money, or doesn't make enough money at least to justify making it.
Yeah, I think you're hitting on one real issue, which is there's a point at which making petrol and refining petrol becomes more challenging, And as soon as you have to try and put that petrol that you're making in Brisbane, for example, on a ship and send it somewhere else, that becomes very, very expensive. And so how you adjust your production to produce more diesel and jet and less petrol over time is an important challenge that needs to be solved because it becomes less profitable.
So what's your current thinking on your business planning around EVs?
So we've been rolling out our EV charging network, public charging, fast charging network for about 5 years now. So this is not, it's not a new thing for us. We've got, as of yesterday, about 354 bays in Australia.
And where are they? Are they in petrol stations or are they in shopping centres?
Both. So we've been rolling out on our forecourts and, you know, linking to our convenience offer, but we're also working with partners in shopping centres, and so we're doing both. What we're focused on is making sure we've got broad network coverage and we're delivering a reliable charging service. So in June, for instance, our uptime was just over 99%. So over 99% means you turn up and the charging system is working. So a real challenge with the electrical connectivity or the comms connectivity in EV charging has been the availability rates. So the customer turns up and is the charging service working has been a bit of a challenge globally. And so one of the things we're really focused on is, do we have the asset set up in the right location and working? And we're really happy with the levels of reliability that we're delivering. And now it's about choosing the right sites where we can get the right electrical connectivity to make sure we're delivering a broad network for our customers, including our fleet customers, because that's what they're looking for.
How does the business model work? I mean, is the margin and the profit anything like what you make on petrol and diesel?
The business model works that margins are certainly lower, but customers need to charge more frequently. And so we're increasingly encouraged by the fact that, you know, we think we can make reasonable returns out of this part of the business, leveraging our convenience offer and leveraging the footprint that we have to make good returns over time. That will take time. And so at the moment, we're effectively building capability because the size of the fleet is about 1 or 2% of the overall light passenger vehicle fleet, but it's growing. And so we want to get our business model set, understand it really well, and start to scale it. And that's what we're doing now.
And what's the long-term plan? Is it to have a fast charger in every petrol station or something?
No, it's very much location dependent. Where do we think the EVs are going to be? And so we track postcodes and data and where the EVs are arriving, what those journeys look like. And from our fleet customers in particular, where the locations are that they need so that they can put an EV in the hands of their employee. They can use an Ampol card, which they will do for their fuel vehicle today. Go and fuel up anywhere. They can put an Ampol card in the hands of their employee. That can handle electrons, which it can. And then they can charge up whenever they need to. So that's the model. Effectively, it's a replication of the current model. But there are some areas where you can't get grid connectivity and some areas where we think actually EV uptake's just not going to hit the requisite levels for a long time. And so our network looks, it leverages the core network, but it looks a little different. And one of the ways it looks a little different is those shopping centre car parks that we're expanding into for EV charging, as well as rolling them out on our own petrol forecourts.
Is there a model where you provide the charge for free so people go and shop while they're getting their car charged, whether it's in your convenience stores or in the shopping centre, and the shopping centre owner pays you for the electricity?
I don't really see that. When you look at the price of electricity and that, I don't really see that it'll go to that extent. But I think what you will see over time is more dynamic pricing as the price of power changes during the day and you're looking to manage the utilisation of the network over time and peak periods. I think that will happen.
Yeah, well, coming, because you get power free in the middle of the day when the sun's shining, particularly if the shopping centre or your convenience store's got panels on the roof.
Yeah, so I think that takes some time to play out, but I think you'll get to a point where, you know, pricing is more dynamic and it reflects the fact that you do have quite variable pricing for power during the day.
And how long does it take to charge?
So at the moment, to charge from sort of 20 to 80% takes about 15 or 20 minutes. Really depends on the vehicle a little bit, but that's typically what we tend to see. the vehicle technology is changing quite rapidly. And, you know, so there's a lot of talk around those charging times coming down to sub 10 minutes over the next 5 years or so. But that's what we're seeing at the moment.
But I mean, obviously, most people charge their cars at home. So I wonder whether what do you think the business of charging publicly, like you do, what's that going to look like? Just people who go on long journeys or something?
Yeah, so I think you've got people who go on long journeys, but you've also got people who live in apartments, and that's more challenging. You've got people who live in areas where the grid's particularly constrained. I think as we're looking to electrify a lot on effectively a grid that has some challenges, a distribution network that has some challenges, it might be too expensive to install charging at home. And then you've got a lot of people that rent. And so when you combine all of that, you actually do have a relatively large addressable market in our view.
Yeah, right. And there's been a lot of talk about a big upsurge in buying of EVs because of the Iran war. Have you noticed that? Have you seen a sort of a particular increase in EV charging and a decline in petrol and diesel sales?
So what we saw early on during the post the Middle East conflict was that fuel demand was up a lot. So our supply chain was very resilient. We were focused on making sure we could supply customers everywhere and communities everywhere. So at times our diesel demand was up 30%. Now it's kind of stabilized back to kind of relatively normal levels, I would say. We have seen EV charging or EV uptake increase. So I think Q2 to date, it's a bit over 18% of new car sales as EVs. It was 8% last year. So that has stepped up, and we have seen that flow through to our charging business. So we've seen utilization step up a bit, not dramatically, but a bit.
Right. But if all your I get the impression from what you're saying that if all of your customers drove EVs instead of internal combustion engines, you'd make less money because the margins are lower on EV charging.
Yeah, but I think customers need to charge more.
Oh, I see.
So it's still too early to make a definitive call on this. But when we look at the size of the addressable market, and I think AEMO put out some data saying that actually on the go or public charging is probably about 30% of all charging, to your question earlier. And people need to charge more frequently, then we see that EV charging can be a profitable business. But it depends on your view of uptake and how that trends over time, because you do need to see uptake extend, you know, significantly above current levels.
Hey, do you think you'll ever own an EV yourself?
Yeah, I'm sure I will.
Right. And do you think the government should help by subsidising some sort of national EV charging system around the country?
Look, I think there's been plenty of work done on how to invest in the grid over time. I think there's a lot of challenges upstream, as is well documented, in terms of generation, storage, and transmission. I think when you get to the last mile, which is what we're talking about in terms of the distribution network and impacting charging. For example, when we roll out a fast charging site, over 3/4 of the investment is not in the charger. It's in the electrical connectivity and the augmentation to the grid. We're targeting the most efficient locations to be able to get that connectivity. Our view would be it becomes more expensive over time. And there are going to be some sites, particularly in, you know, areas where there's a lot of congestion, or areas in rural and regional communities where it's going to be more challenging. And that's where there is going to be funding required over time, I think.
Just on the subject of climate change, we're currently seeing a really brutal heat wave in Europe. Shocking maximum temperatures across Germany and Poland and so on. Is Ampol still committed to net zero by 2050, and how are you going to do that?
Yeah, so I think we are. We put out our decarb strategy in 2021, I think it was, and we updated it, and we've updated it twice now, and we put in place our updated sustainability and climate disclosures under the new climate reporting regulations earlier this year as part of our annual report. Look, the refinery is the most capital intensive part of our operating business, significantly. So that is a challenge as we look to navigate fuel security on the one hand and carbon on the other. And that's an ongoing discussion as we talked to earlier. When we think about Scope 3 emissions, which is really where the bulk of emissions, obviously.
What do you mean by that?
The fuel that's combusted by our customers.
Oh, yeah.
That's where, outside of our own operating business, most of the emissions sit in the combustion of fuel products by our customers. And so what we're doing is, on the EV side, we're rolling out our EV network that we've spoken about. We're very committed to that. We've got, across Australia and New Zealand, well over 550 bays, and we'll continue to roll those out so that customers can make that transition. It's more challenging on the jet fuel and the heavy diesel side. That is a genuinely hard to abate area. The logical solution in our view is low carbon liquid fuels, and that is the refining of non-crude oil based feedstock, so canola, animal fats and wastes, for example.
Could Lytton Refinery do that?
Yeah, so we're studying the development of a project up there. We're working with GrainCorp and with IFM investors on a study up there. Currently, about 70% of the oil from canola gets exported to other countries to manufacture these fuels. And so one of the policy settings the government is currently contemplating is what policy is required to hold those feedstocks in Australia and refine them locally. So that we'll continue to look at how that policy evolves. And then, yes, Lytton possibly could refine those products in the future. And that has a fuel resilience angle, if you like, or benefit in addition to the decarb benefit, in addition to benefits for regional communities. So that's the logical solution. There's no easy one, but it does require us to look at government policy to stand it up.
The other solution for diesel is hydrogen fuel cells. Are you looking at that? And would you have a role to play in that?
We've looked at it. We think it's more challenging than low carbon liquid fuels, at least over the next 10 or 20 years. So we have at the moment parked it, and we're far more focused on those low carbon liquid fuels as the logical solution and the most efficient solution, at least for the next 10 or 20 years.
And what about renewable electricity for your charging stations? Do you have to make, in order to meet your net zero commitments, do you have to make sure that that is renewable electricity?
Yeah, so we low carbon certificates we need to buy as part of rolling out those that offer, and then effectively over time it's about ensuring that or buying from the grid, and as the grid decarbonises, then that EV charging offer benefits accordingly.
Well, we'll leave it there, Matt Halliday. Thanks very much.
Thanks for your time, Alan.
Thanks so much for joining me on That's Business. You can find That's Business on the ABC Business Daily feed every Friday. And make sure you follow ABC Business Daily on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. And also, if you like it, tell your friends about us. Carrington Clark and the ABC Business Daily team will be back in the feed on Monday.